is everybody ready for an amazing speaker? Yeah. When the committee was talking about speakers, Dee had a list of all of the speakers that we were going to choose from, and I'm pretty sure it was like unanimous on tonight's speaker of who it was going to be and which night it was going to be at. So I'm going to invite Kenny up here to introduce Janice.
All right, Kenny.
Hello, my name's Kenny and I'm an addict.
Hi, Kenny.
Well, I'm here to introduce Janice. I'm forever grateful to have Janice in my life. You know, we're family. We're first cousins. Our mom, we're sisters. And she's a big reason that I'm here, because I know Narcotics Anonymous changed and saved her life. And for me to see her grow, and, you know, throughout the years, and me bugging her about money, you know, and she's the one that I'm standing here. Because, I don't believe if I ever had a family member in Narcotics Anonymous, I wouldn't be standing here today. And I thank you, Janice. And Janice is amazing. Janice loves and breathes Narcotics Anonymous. I mean, she is a proud member and a grateful member of Narcotics Anonymous, and she has an amazing story of hope. And I love you so much, Janice.
Everybody, my name's Janice, and I'm a grateful recovering addict.
Hi, Janice.
Let me get the phone out so I know how long I'm going to be here. Wow. Thank you, Kenny. Oh, my goodness. You know, I often say that I do not think about what I'm going to share until I get up here, so sometimes I choke. I'm like, oh God, what am I going to say? I think I'm having that moment now. But first and foremost, you know, I want to thank the God of my understanding, you know, to allow me to be here tonight, to feel what I feel, to learn what the universe and the amazing fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous has taught me and brought to me. And, you know, without that, you know, I'd either be dead or in prison or jail somewhere for a long time. And everything I'm going to probably share with you, it's not original. You know, I didn't know anything until I got here, and I'm an addict. Maybe some of y'all relate. I thought I knew everything. And if I didn't know it, I was going to watch and learn and figure it out. And because I was so smart. And the other people I want to thank is the committee, you know, for all your service, all your hard work. I know it's not easy, you know. We have an area where, you know, we probably need to pay people to do something, you know what I mean? It's hard. We need to take a collection or something to get people sometimes. But, you know, the spirit of service is probably one of the most spiritual parts of this program for me, to give back what was so freely given. I usually don't get nervous at all when I'm asked to share, because I could never in a million years repay Narcotics Anonymous back for everything. And I guess the biggest thing is freedom from self, and freedom from active addiction, freedom from the razor wires and the cells, you know, all of it, you know. And so I don't really get nervous because, like Brian said last night, I love and am in love with Narcotics Anonymous. Yeah. And I love people who love Narcotics Anonymous, man, I do. And, you know, I got here through a facility that brought me to meetings in a white van, you know, the famous term, the druggy buggy. And, you know, and it was my beginning. I mean, you know, and I'll share with you, though, that even though that I went to that first meeting on that van, that first night I was at this facility, it was not my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. Listen, I know I'm going to sound ADD, but I'll be jumping around. I can't help it. I was going to say that I celebrated 21 years in this fellowship in March, a couple weeks back, right? And thank you guys for that. And that was 2003, March 12, 2003. But I had heard the message in the late 80s or early 90s in a prison called Broward Correctional Institution for Women. It was in West Broward, west of Fort Lauderdale, way out, like right on the edge of the Everglades. It was at the end of civilization. And I did a lot of time there. And while I was there, H&I came in. Yes, they did. And they brought the message. They brought the message of hope. They came in and they carried this vibration. They carried this energy of love and what do we say, brotherly love. I mean, they had it. And we felt it. And we knew they were about something good. But, you know, at me anyway, I was a hard head. I wasn't ready. I just thought, what an amazing program for someone who needs it, you know? I did. I really did. And, you know, and I met a few of the guys that brought the men and women. And many years later, you know, I had the pleasure of breaking bread with them and, you know, hanging out and fellowshipping. But at that time, you know, this was the message they brought. Any addict, right, can stop using and lose the desire to use and find a new way to live. That's the message they carried. Their energy carried love, hope, all of it, you know. And again, that was in 1980s. I was probably in my late 20s, early 30s, and I didn't hear it, you know. I heard it, but it didn't stay. And so 2003, I heard that message again, and I wasn't even ready then. It took about 60 days in, and then the light bulb came on, and, you know, I had that moment of, like, this is what I got to do. I am an addict, you know. And I got honest. I practiced some humility. I realized that I didn't know anything. You know, I walked into that treatment center 46 years old, and out of those 46, I had been locked up 23. 7 years the first time and 16 the second time. So, but I walked, and I always say this is a screenshot of my disease, but I walked into that treatment center thinking, they're going to see how smart I am. They're going to notice right away that I do not need this. They're going to throw me out of here in a week, you know. That's a big screenshot of it because, you know, through what you guys have taught me, working the steps, having a sponsor, going to meetings, all of it, I learned that the drugs, it's always going to be about the drugs. But it's not only about the drugs. Because when they took away the drugs, what was I left with? Me. Yeah. And, you know, the best thinking part, you know, was the 23 years in Florida State prisons and getting out. I got out after 7 years and I couldn't stay out. I didn't know I was an addict. I didn't know it was the first one, not the second, not the 100th, not... you know, I didn't know it was the first one that absolutely changed everything, and I couldn't stop, didn't want to stop, I wouldn't stop until I was locked up or possibly dead, you know. And I didn't know any of that. So when I got out, you know, I went back. And when I went back the second time, I stayed for 16 years. And when I got out after 16, I went back at 26. And I got out at 42. The first time I went in at 17, and I got out at 24. You know, so I basically was raised up, you know, in prison. So when I got to that treatment center, I was severely institutionalized, you know. I'm going to need some water. And severely institutionalized, had other things going on. I didn't know I had post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety and, you know, things. I didn't know any of that. But first and foremost, I didn't know how to live, you know. I didn't know how to live not just on the outside, but on, you know, in the inside either. I mean, I thought I knew how to live in there. Because you couldn't tell me I wasn't running the place, you know, like, because I'm an addict, you know, and you know, that's probably one of the greatest gifts that I got here is learning about what the disease is, how it manifests in my life, how it manifests in my spirit, in my behavior, in my thinking, and that combination creates, you know, hell for me and everybody else I'm around. So, again, you know, I didn't have this organized. I feel like I'm all over the place, but I'm gonna keep going. That's what y'all taught me. Keep on, just keep it moving. And so, I grew up in, my dad was, you know, a severe alcoholic, severe addict. We were very poor, you know, we moved around a lot, we were homeless a lot. My mom hustled the tourist trade down there in South Florida, so we moved from this tourist attraction to that tourist attraction. She sold, souvenirs, and, you know, we were in this school, we were in dad's school, we moved a lot, like I said, and my dad could not, you know, he was a real addict, you know, when he was using. He probably took 3 showers a day. He was, you know, OCD with his clothes and the Elvis hair and, you know. And when he drank, he was the drunk that lived behind 7-Eleven for months at a time, begging for quarters out front, right? So back when we were little, he was violent, and he'd come home and jump on my mom. It was the, you know, it was the domestic violence of the black eyes and bloody nose, and, you know, the next day, you know, he's got on sunglasses, and, you know, and everybody's going on like nothing happened after all this, you know, chaos and violence. And I remember there was 4 of us. I had 2 brothers, 1 passed, and my sister. So there was 4 of us, and when these episodes were happening, you know, we would be huddled up in the corner just screaming and crying, you know, daddy, daddy, stop, stop, you know, terrified in the corner, just screaming. And, you know, I know today that was a big part of this development of my evolution of addiction. Because that first feeling that I remember that intensely is fear. You know, I was afraid. I was, you know, I loved my mom, I loved my dad, but this is happening, what the hell? And that's when we were real little. Then when I got a little older, you know, he was still drinking, probably around the age of 6, one of his drinking buddies molested me. And in the moment it happened, you know, I always refer to this, that you hear a term paralyzed with fear. And again, it was fear, but at this time also something else came in, which was the numbing out. The going away in my head in order to get through this, or you know, I couldn't really process it, so I just numbed it, you know. I learned how not to feel. And unfortunately, that wasn't the first time an episode like that happened before I was the age of 12. And so there goes the fear, there goes the numbing, and then there goes the masks. Because I couldn't tell my mom what was going on because I felt like she had had enough with my dad. I can't bring her any more, you know, misery. So I never told her. She came home from work and I'm in a state of like terror. I had to act like nothing was wrong. I'm acting normal and I'm dying inside. So there goes the masks, fear, escaping my feelings or numbing my feeling, and then the mask and the secrets, right? I can't tell it, so it's a secret. And, you know, I guess it was around 12, 11 that then the behavior started. So I'm skipping school. I'm, you know, smoking Marlboro Lights because that's what everybody else was smoking. And I didn't even know how to smoke a cigarette, really. I just was doing what other bad kids did because that's who I liked, the bad kids. And by 12, you know, it was just, I think it was the around 12, the first time I picked up a mind mood alter. It probably was weed and alcohol, because that's what all the neighborhood kids got into eventually, was weed and alcohol. And I remember thinking, and I can't remember if I got really, really high. I just remember feeling different, you know, because there was the terror, and then there was the molestation. The feelings behind that, I mean, the other feelings that developed later on was like shame. You know, I was ashamed of what had happened. In the moment, I could numb my feelings, but later on, I felt ashamed. I felt dirty. I felt like something is wrong with me. You know, I was too immature to say something is wrong with them. I started to adapt and adopt to that victim mentality. Like, what's wrong with me that this happens to me? So, you know, by the age of 12, when I picked up a substance, yay, right? Like, this is all I need. This is it. All I got to do is stay high and I'm going to be all right. So at the age of 12, it began the finding ways and means to get more. I, you know, used to live and live to use. And that included, you know, skipping school and stealing. And it just went downhill, you know. And by the time I think I was 15 when I stole a car, maybe 14 or something. And I went to jail. Because it was like a juvenile thing. I didn't even have to go to jail, but once again, you know, an addict, I was angry. I forgot about that part. The fear and the shame and all of it, it morphed into an anger. And the anger eventually morphed into a rage, you know. And it wasn't an obvious rage, like I didn't go around beating up on people or yelling, or it wasn't like that. Most of the rage was inward. I was always doing shit to hurt myself. You know, and others, I stole somebody's car and and stole from all the stores I could get in. And that was one of my other big highs, was shoplifting, stealing. You know, that was a great high. It was exciting, the adrenaline, and you know, so I didn't have to go to jail. The judge was trying to say, why did you steal the car? And I got mouthy with him, and that's why he sent me to jail. The mouthiness was the rebelliousness, the anger, you know, like rebelliousness, you know, that's a defect I still work with today. You know, it took me a long time to wear a seatbelt. The speeding is, I'm still working on that a lot. I love to speed. I drive a Cadillac, and they came out with a new edition with a V something. It's like a supercharged motor. And my mind told me, you know, when he's talking about arrested and paroled, you know, it gets paroled, you know. I said, you know, I need to get that car, you know, and drive real fast. But, you know, today, thanks to the gifts and the steps and the program of Narcotics Anonymous, I have come to acknowledge, be aware of, and recognize the disease of addiction when it's talking to me in my voice, right? So I don't get the car. I'm not going to get it. You know, I'm still working on the speeding. But my point was the rebelliousness. I came to understand that rebelliousness, anti-authority, don't tell me what to do, is the cover for anger. You know, and I wish that I could say that I'm not angry at anybody anymore. There's many days I'm not angry at anybody anymore, but there could be a day, a moment, when I'm hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, and I could feel a resentment to someone who did something to me a long time ago. It could raise its head, but because of the steps, and especially the 11th step, you know, I have changed. You know, when I walked in, they told me, the same person who walked in will use again. So what did that tell me? It told me that it is about changing, you know. Transforming, for me, is the word I like. Transforming. And how did I do that? I did that by surrendering, getting honest, practicing spiritual principles. But the first thing was getting a sponsor. Going to meetings. If you're new, you know, all of these words that we say, it's a language. It's a language that I have learned. You know, I didn't know it when I got here. You know, and it's not just the words, though. It's the action behind it. So the only reason I got a sponsor while I was in treatment was because my mind said, I'm in this facility because I'm paroled to this facility, and if I don't do everything they say, I'm not going to, you know, satisfy my parole requirements, and I got to get out of this place, so let me get a sponsor. And you know, and she graciously started working steps with me while I was still in treatment. I got the sponsor. I started working steps. I went to meetings after meetings after meetings. And one of the sayings is, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle, right? So, thanks to the state of Florida and the parole commission, I couldn't really leave, you know. I mean, I could. We always have a choice. But, you know, I was at a point in my life where I just did not want to go back. And at the time, of course, it was about not going back to prison. And so that's what happened. If you're new, it's about going to the meetings, getting a sponsor, working the steps, getting honest with somebody, you know, little by little. You know, I didn't do all of this in one day, you know. And I really had to take it easy because the first year I was out of treatment, the first year I went to this one meeting, this women's meeting, and everybody in that meeting will tell you, I probably said 10 words in that whole year. You know, I couldn't talk. I couldn't. My sponsor says, now you couldn't talk. Now we can't shut you up. You know? I talk a little more now. But yeah, it was just like, I'm just saying that because if you're new, you know, we didn't become addicted in one day, you know. And I didn't get recovery. I didn't get these 21 years in one day. It was one day at a time. One choice at a time, one thought at a time, one surrendering at a time. It could, you know, and it's been amazing. It's been amazing. So, the anger. See, I get all off the beaten track path words too. So, I got to the treatment center because I had gone back to prison for the third time. You know, I got out 7 years. I did 2 years and 9 months on the streets. I used. I went back. I was inside for 16 years. But in that 12th year of those 16 years, I had a spiritual experience that, you know, I grew up in the Everglades, around and near the Everglades. My father's people, my mother's people. My mom wasn't even born in a hospital. They were born in the woods and out in the Everglades. And my father's family practiced the native traditions of my tribe, you know, the medicine and all the rituals. I grew up knowing about it, and I knew about the what we called Fishakiyumichi, which means the breath maker. I grew up with a God, a higher power in my life. My mother's side had converted to Christianity, so we also grew up as Baptists. And you say, no wonder you ended up in NA, right? But yeah, we had Jesus and the medicine man, and you know, we had it all. And so my point is, I grew up knowing there was a creator, that there was a higher power, that there was a spiritual energy in this world that could help me, that could guide me, that could love me. But you know, as my path went, and I went from, you know, being afraid to being ashamed to being angry, you know, I turned away from that spiritualness, and I ended up where I ended up. So by the time I'm 13 and 14, all these feelings and behaviors behind these feelings, I became suicidal. By the age of 13 and 14, I did not want to live anymore. I just felt like nothing was ever going to get better. You know, this is that, that's this, this is the way it is, and I hate everything. And I, you know, what I was really saying that I didn't know then is that I hate myself. And I just don't want to live anymore. So by the time I'm 15, I'd gotten kicked out of school again. And I was, I was using hallucinogens. And I started to get this voice in my head that said, you just got to kill yourself. It's not going to work. No matter what you do, it does, with this downer voice. Just so I was 15, and I made a decision that I'm just going to end my life, that I can't do anything better than this. And I stole a gun. It was New Year's Eve, 1972. My brother had a little New Year's Eve party, and everybody was clearing out, and I said, when everybody leaves, I'm going in my room, I'm going to blow my brains out. And as destiny, fate, whatever you want to say, would have it, a guy came by and asked me to run him up to the convenience store to get some sodas. Well, I have the gun with me. When I got there, I saw that the cashier, it's a gentleman, was by himself, and I immediately thought, I don't have to kill myself. I can just rob this store, take that money, and haul ass. Just run away somewhere. You know, this, my mind told me this is a solution. And I asked my friend to help me, and he was absolutely like, you are crazy. No, no. And somehow I talked him into it, and in the... I know. These addicts. What did they say? They could sell ice to the snowman or something? To the Eskimo. Something like that. But anyway, in the course of the robbery, I shot and killed the cashier. And we ran away, and then we got away for like a year. They didn't know who did it. It was an investigation and everything. And about a year later, I was arrested, and I was arrested. By this time, I'm 16, and I turned 17 in jail, so I was adjudicated as an adult, and I was given a life sentence for second-degree murder. The prosecutor accepted a second degree because I was 15 years old. And I got a life sentence. And I tell people today, it's crazy, but back then you could get paroled out in 7 years on a life sentence, you know. I don't know about everywhere else, but in Florida, if you get a life sentence today, it's life, you know. But I, like I told you, I went in, I'm 17, and I'm a full-blown addict, you know, not just in the using substances, but here, right? Because the addiction is here. Y'all taught me that here. I learned that addiction is not just the drugs. I use the drugs to try to fix my addiction. What's my addiction? It's the way that I think. It's the way that I perceive things. You know, like, it's different from so-called normal people, if there is such a thing. I was talking at this men's halfway a few months ago, and I told him, I said, the difference between the addict, I'll give you a little example, I said, and the regular guy is that if they're walking down the street, one is an addict and he trips over something, you know, the one that's not an addict will probably just look and, oh well, keep going, you know. An addict will stumble over something and say, who put that there? And why does this always happen to me? And who saw me? You know, the self-centered self, right? So I didn't know all that. I got in there and 17. I didn't go in there thinking, I have a life sentence. I need to be good. I need to do everything. No, I went in there. I didn't say, where's the chapel? I was a full-blown addict. I went in there and I was saying, so what's up? What's going on? What are we going to do? You know? What do y'all do? And I fell in with people who knew how to do stuff. And then, you know, I got in trouble. I went to lockdown. I got in trouble all the time. Miraculously, I got out somehow after 7 years. I got paroled. I went on work release. And work release, I smoked a joint. Somebody said, you want to get high? I said, yeah. For some reason, y'all might understand this, my mind never said, Janice, if you get caught, you're going to go back in for a long, long time. That if it came through, it went right out, right? And long story short, you know, I got back into it, and I got heavily into it, and I went back. I went back, and when the parole board reviewed my case, they said, well, the guidelines have changed a little bit, so now we're giving you a parole date 25 years away, and we're going to review you every 22 months, and in those, if, you know, according to your behavior, you can work that date down. You know, 25 years, take a year off, you know, like crazy to me. And I thought, I walked out of there, and again, the normal person would probably say, oh my God, I cannot get in trouble. I got to do everything they say. I got to follow these rules. I walked out and said, F that. If they're going to keep me locked up, whether I'm good or bad, I'm going to do my time the way I want. You know, they don't tell me what to do. There goes the rebelliousness and the anger, right? They're not going to tell me what to do. So I proceeded to hurt myself for the next 12 years. You know, I got in everything. You know, we loan sharked, we smuggled in drugs, we made hooch in the kitchen, we made, you know, everything we could do. I stole everything in the kitchen that wasn't nailed down and sold it on the compound, you know, onions for your ramen soup. Here I am. Remember that guy in the movie Shawshank? I can get things. Yeah. I thought I was a badass gangster. I really did. Peddling onions. Screenshot. That's what I did. I got in trouble, and then like 12 years in, I'm getting locked up again. You know, when we say, and we've been hearing it a lot, what we can't do alone, we can do together, right? And at 12 years in, I just, you know, I said, you know, they got this in-house drug program. First of all, my date is not coming down. You know, I've gotten so many write-ups. My date is going back. They're adding, right? So I had this moment, and I said, you know, I gotta do something. And I got in the drug program there in-house, and I was in there for like 30 days or so, and I used, and I got caught. And they dropped the urine, and I went to confinement again for 60 days. And I'm walking down the stairs, and I had an experience. I thought about my mother and the church and my dad and the medicine, and I just had that moment of clarity, like, you're a parole violator on a life sentence on a murder charge, and you're never going to get out of this place if you don't do something. And the screenshot was, but you think you're running them. You think you're getting over on them. And in that moment, you know, I had that moment of like, shit, what's wrong with me? And I cried out to a God of my understanding at that time, and I changed my ways. I quit using, I quit hustling, I quit breaking the rules, and I got out. In 1999, like I told you, at the age of 42, after 16 years, right? So I got out thinking, all I gotta do is not commit crimes, don't get in trouble, and don't get high. That's it. So, just like the drugs, that's on the outside, right? Nothing had really changed in the inside. You know, and they tell you a million times, I was told a million times, it's an inside job. And I didn't have it. I got out, I started working, I started overworking, I started getting resentful, I was tired, I was just the resentment. You know, why I gotta do all this? Nobody's helping me. My brother this, my mom that, And I stopped at a gas station and I got a beer, one beer. I said, I just need to chill out. This is after the 16 years, you know. And I got a beer and I drove off. And I probably got a case of beer the next night, you know. I remember there was a couple of six packs in my fridge. So I don't know if it was 2 weeks, I don't know if it was a week, I don't know what it was, but I got high and I drove and I got in a car accident. And I went back. And I thought, you know, it was almost like, you know, the disease was dancing this little Irish jig in the background, right? Like, I got you now. And my mind was telling me, I'm never gonna get another chance. Never gonna get out. And I just was defeated, like, what the hell is wrong with me? And, you know, and if you haven't kind of caught a glimpse of it, there was something going along in the background the whole time. You know, there was a God in my life. There was something looking out for me. There was something helping me when I could not help myself. So I get to back to the prison, and this is a God actual, you know, we're talking miracles here, right? This is a miracle that the parole board said, well, she's done enough time and it hasn't helped. Maybe we failed her. Do you know the parole commission in California, Texas, and Florida could never say some shit like that? I mean, it's like a miracle. It's not like, it's a miracle. And they said, so we'll send her, and my lawyer happened to be there, and he said, Janice is a good person who has an illness that she's never been treated for, and I have no doubt in my mind that if she gets treatment, she'll become a productive member of society. I guess he knew our lingo a little bit, right? And the parole board agreed, and that's how I walked into that treatment center at 46 years old. Severely, it's, yeah. Miracles! And I told you I was all over the place, so I forgot to mention that the readings that we just read and we read before every meeting, which comes straight out of here, right? That's why it says the miracles start here. When I sat in the meetings from that treatment center night after night after night, these readings were like, la, 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 you know, the first few rounds, you know? And the longer I sat and the longer I listened, the sooner I began to hear them. Who is an addict? You know, why are we here? And then the speakers that came and shared their experience, strength, and hope, I started to identify with them. I started to relate to them. I said, I've done that. I've felt like that. That's crazy, you know, like, and so the miracle started there. It really did when I heard those readings and I started to understand and internalize them. And, man, I went blank for a minute. So I get there, and like I told you, I just didn't, you know, I thought I didn't know until I knew. And when I finally surrendered, you know, I was open-minded. I became a little bit willing. And I heard one of the therapists say in a group, he said, humans develop a conscience between the ages of 1 and 6, right? And he said it in a group and it stuck in my mind, and after the group I said, if humans develop a conscience, I said, how come I didn't feel anything when I shot and killed this man? And I'm straight faced, no emotions, because I was shut down, you know. First I had, I always say this, first I had the Indian shut down, the Native American, you're not gonna smile, no expression, nothing, right? And then I had the convict shut down, no expression, you'll never know how I'm feeling, you know, just shut down. So when I went to him and I told him that, he said, I didn't know this, he says, but would you like to do some work on that? And I wanted to say, absolutely effing not, you know, I had, what? But you know, I was coming to a crossroads in my life, like, what am I going to do, stay the same? Am I going to try something? You know, and I got to tell you, as soon as he said it, like fear gripped my heart, you know, like I was terrified, like what is he talking? What he said is, Janice, I want you to write a letter. I want you to write a letter to yourself. Because when he said that and I wanted to say, hell no, I had instead I said, yeah. And he said, well, I want you to write a letter, and I want you to write a letter to yourself as if it was from the man you killed. And at that time, I knew his name was Charles, because when I was arrested at 16 years old, they told me his name. And he said, I want you to write this letter to yourself as if it's from Charles. And when he said that, I thought fear and terror had gripped me a minute ago. This was worse, you know. And for about 2 weeks, you know, I just proceeded to cry and cry and start to feel. And this was like 30 years later now, 30 years later. And I can tell you that when I was in jail, when I was in prison, people I knew, I could tell you, yeah, I robbed the store, I shot the man and he died and I got life and da da da. I could talk about it from here. Never went anywhere else. So when he said that, it opened the door, it opened the window, it cracked it open, and I started to feel, and I started to cry, and I started to grieve, and I started to have shame and guilt and remorse, and it was terrifying and it was horrible, and I did not know how I was going to write this letter. But after about a week, I sat down, and again, I was at a crossroads. What am I going to do? Am I going to try something different? Am I going to try to change? Because, you know, I'm here and I got here, and I want to know how not to get here again and to be better. So I wrote the letter, and about a week later, he said, I want you to read it. And actually, you know, I got to tell you, I don't know how I wrote the letter, because it was the tears and the snot, and it was bad. I couldn't even see the paper, but somehow I managed it. And in the same way, I tried to read the letter, I was crying. And I share it every time, like it was the first time. Because it's always been impactful to me. I hope it never stops. In the first line of this letter that I wrote said, and this is Charles writing the letter, the first line said, Janice, I know how you and I crossed paths that night. You know, and because of what I learned as a kid about spirituality, in that moment, I knew that I know that I killed Charles's body, but in that moment I also acknowledged that I did not kill his soul. That his spirit exists somewhere. And that I believe when we cross over, you know, my people believe that we, you know, we bury our deceased facing the sunset, because that's where we're going to journey into the sunset, into the next, what do they call it? Form. That's another word. I couldn't think of another word. But it's a journey. The spirit journeys on. So, but I also believe that we return to the source from which we all came. You know, and I believe that we all come from one source. You know, and you know, in our life here, in my life here, I am a woman, I am a Native American, I am an American, I am a member of Narcotics Anonymous, I'm all these things, but you know, through the practice of the 11th step, you know, I've had amazing meditations, and there's a meditation that I went to one time, or over and over actually, where I'm no longer Janice. I'm no longer a woman. I'm no longer anything but a piece of the source. a part of God. You know, we are the expression of the everlasting, of the, what did they say, the Alpha and the Omega. It has no beginning, it has no end. What is it made of? I believe it's made of love, compassion, understanding, you know, all the good things. And it's a, to an energy level that my little human mortal brain can't even comprehend. You know, I'm sure some of you that have children, for me it's pets. Sometimes I can look into my dog's little face and the amount of love, you know, I just love my dogs. Like I love NA. I can look into you guys and I can feel that feeling of this overwhelming love. And I know it's just a little piece of what God is, right? So if Charles returned to this, Charles can see me and my brothers and sisters crying and screaming in the corner. Charles can see me, know that I got molested many times, know that our life was so crazy. And Charles, I felt the spiritual principle of compassion that he could feel for me. When we say we didn't become addicted in one day, that 15-year-old girl didn't end up in that store in one day, right? And like all of us, we didn't get here in one day. I love you guys, by the way. I really do.
We love you.
I really do. I'm feeling it right now, okay?
Yeah,
and the next line of the letter said, so I believed it. You know, all of most of life and recovery is comes down to choice. And I choose to believe it. I choose to believe that he could have compassion for me. And the next line said, and I'm not mad at you. And again, being a part of the source, being a part of this incomprehensible love, he could forgive me. He could forgive me. And I choose to accept that on a daily basis. And the last line said, and I'm not dead. I'm just not here. And you know, that was the letter. As short as it was, it changed my life forever. And you know, after I read it, you know, the angels didn't come out and I was like, you know, transformed and I was like all shining white. No, I felt worse. Because now I've taken accountability. I've taken responsibility for taking someone's life. And how am I going to live with this? And I asked the therapist, I said, what am I going to do? I was feeling so heavy and sad. And he says, Janice, he said, you have to turn the negative into a positive. He said, it's just like the serenity prayer. He said, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. You know, and I've said it many times, I couldn't do enough time. I couldn't shoot, snort, drink enough. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't do nothing enough to bring him back or to change what happened. God grant me the serenity to accept. I accept what I did. I did it. And the courage to change the things I can. What can I change? Me, this, right? When I change this, it changes my perception, my thinking, my feelings, my behavior, you know, my behavior behind my feelings, all of that. It started to change when he said that. And he said, and the wisdom to know the difference. And that comes from, at that time, a God of my understanding. Today, it comes from all of the principles in the 12 steps. Don't forget. And it comes from all of you. Just like a while ago, when I just felt so connected to each and every one of you, and I still do, but I did have that moment. And, you know, it doesn't go away. You know, my recovery has to be fluid. You know, I have to be evolving every day. You know, maybe it's just a little bit once a day, or maybe it's like all day, I'm in prayer, or, you know, whatever it is, my recovery has to be, I'll use that word a lot, active.
activated. You know, it has to be alive. Because, just like Brian said, this shit gets paroled, you know. It can ask for parole. And sometimes it does come out for a few. But my main thing is that when he said that, I said, okay, I got to live my life in his honor, in Charles's honor. His name was Charles Henry Davis. And about a couple of years clean, I was asked to speak at a Native American treatment center out in the Everglades. And I was driving out there. It was night, and there was a gazillion billion stars out. And I'm going to this treatment center. I haven't spoken very much. I'm very nervous at the time. And I'm like, oh, what am I going to say? And I looked up at the sky, and I saw all the stars. And then I remembered. I said, Charles is up there. Charles is Charles. And I called out to him. I said, Charles, help me. Help me share a message. Share a message of recovery. Share a message of hope. And, you know, I had this little communion with him, and we did a little fist bump there, and you know, on 41. And that was the beginning of my journey of doing this, you know, of living my life in his honor. I live my life in service. I will help anyone and everyone inside and out of the program in any way I can. And if we all, you know, if we all just remember who we are, you know, like we're all beings on this planet. We're all spirits in this human form, you know, and we're really all the same. And that, you know, what's going to cure us is love, you know. And if I can keep that in my conscious awareness on a daily basis, and how do I do that? The 11th step. When my eyes open in the morning, if it's not the serenity prayer, usually my first prayer is thank you. Thank you. You know, and even if I'm not feeling it, because, you know, I suffer from a little depression, and somebody was saying I'm not a morning person. I'm not, you know. Sometimes when I wake up, I have, and again, it's that thing trying to get paroled. I feel sad, you know. I feel like, oh, I don't want to get up. And then I'm like, oh, shit, it's applying for parole right now, you know. Because I have nothing to feel bad about. Nothing. My life is amazing. You know, I go to meetings. I do H&I, you know. I love my H&I detox commitment. You know, I run there every other Monday. I help people. I help dogs. You know, I got 5 in my house right now. And, you know, I just love to give, and I love to help. And, you know, and now it's not only in honor of my friend Charles. You know, me and Charles got a good relationship today. There's no guilt. There's no shame. There's no anger. I understand him, and he understands me. You know, and real quick, I don't know how much more time I got. Now? 10? Oh, thank you. All right, we have to tell this story before I go. I have so many, but, you know, a guy that asked me to share at this IRT treatment center many years ago, when he introduced me, he said, you know, and I'm saying this because in the miracle business, you know, things happen. And when he introduced me, and it doesn't always impact me, but it impacted me that day. He said, you don't hear a story like Janice's too much, because people like Janice don't get out. They're locked up pretty much for good. He said, so it really is a miracle. And I always remember that. So in my recovery, you know, I've learned to really, you know, like the 11th and the 12th step are my guides. And I can't really go wrong. None of the spiritual principles you can go wrong. So after about 15 years on parole, because, you know, I've been in the system since I'm 16 years old, right? I'm either incarcerated or on life parole. When I violate, I go back, I'm incarcerated. When they let me out, I'm on life parole again. I've been in the system almost my whole life. 15 years of recovery, I decided, it's around 15 years. No, it was a little more. about 18 years, I decided to petition. And two parole officers in my years of parole said, you never get off of life parole, that you can get your supervision reduced and not have to report every month, this, this, and this, but you never get off life parole. And, you know, but I believe in miracles, and I decided to petition for it. And since I've been in recovery, because I generate an energy, you know, of abundance, of goodwill, of brotherly love, you know, they say what you put out comes back, right? It's a law. So things came to me. I acquired a couple of businesses. I wasn't even looking for it, right? And they did well. So in 2018, I believe it was 2018, I chartered two Learjets, and we packed up all my addicts, right, and my family, and we flew to Tallahassee to go to this 22-month review. And I had the mayor of Bay Harbor as one of my support, right? A mayor now. You know what I'm saying? This is what happens, y'all. You know, miracles. And y'all know that. And so she speaks for me. Then the parole commission wants to speak to me, and they start asking me questions. And I had the opportunity to share the letter with them. I shared the letter from Charles that, and you could tell, you know, like it affected them. And the next question, and then they asked me, they said, well, how come your parole officer recommends no change? I love saying this part. I want to say, because she's an effing bitch. But I didn't. I said, because she doesn't know me. I said, we haven't been together that long, and, you know, other parole officers that know me longer know me to be different or know me better. Anyway, they huddled up, and they said, when they finished huddling up, they looked at me and they said, Miss Billy, we've decided not. And there was a pause, and my heart like froze, and they said, we've decided not to take her recommendation, and we're granting you termination of your life parole. You know, and I share because somebody shared with me. I try to give back everything that was so freely given to me. Because today my life is amazing, you know. I mean, if there's any misery, you know, I just self-create it. You know, I'm still an addict, you know. But for the most part, I live a very good life. Why? Because I serve. I want to do for Charles, but for my fellow human beings on this planet. You know, not just the two-legged, but the four-legged too. And I love my life. I love all of you so much. I really appreciate you for letting me share. I hope I had a message of hope for you. Thank you.